This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in first with Dan Carden with The Times. He covers local political news and state political news, too, because the State House is still in session. But today, we're focusing in on local politics. And Dan, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's get started right away with the big controversy du jour. And we're talking about Mr. Michael B. Brown. And remember to put his middle name and middle initial in there because we don't want him to be confused with somebody else who's out there, too. Mr. Michael B. Brown is the Lake County Recorder. We've had stories about him, and you've talked about in the past here about his no-show at work. Now this the latest controversy, I guess, is some felony charges have been filed against him. Bring us up to date on that and the latest that you've heard about that you have in the stories.
The Recorder Brown was arrested on Monday by Hobart police in connection with domestic violence allegations. He's been accused of attacking his girlfriend in various ways at various times on multiple occasions with children in the room. He, at this point, as far as I know, is denying the allegations, but he was arrested and charged with 8 felony domestic violence counts, taken to jail. He actually bonded out on Tuesday night, said he was at work on Wednesday, which is unusual since he spent about 2 years not going to work. So that's, I guess, a good change for him. And now he's out of jail, and he's due to make his first court appearance later this month, February 26th.
Now, I understand you had an opportunity to try and catch up with Mr. Brown, and you actually got to talk, just briefly with him, and you had a chance to talk the much longer, apparently, with his attorney. And that's turned into another story, which is in the paper today.
Right, yeah. I tried reaching out to the Recorder once yesterday afternoon once I learned that he was out of jail.
Yeah.
And just gave him a call, and he answered the phone. He said he was the Recorder. He remembered me from covering the Lake County Council, and apparently his attorney was right there in the room with him because he pretty much immediately handed over the phone, and the attorney did all the talking for the Recorder. The attorney is Michael Woods, the Strachey Law Group in Crown Point.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he believes, or that they're arguing that Mike Brown, the Recorder, is the victim here. His attorney said that they believe the evidence is going to show that Mike Brown actually suffered from months of mental and physical abuse, that the accuser is manipulating the system rather than the other way around.
Well, this sounds like it's an interesting development that will no doubt make for an interesting case when it goes to court, to be sure. Because I'm sure that if he hasn't already decided he's going to plead not guilty, then it's going to show up in court when this court hearing is coming up here later. And I'm sure that we'll end up, if it's not mentioned, I guess it goes to a plea deal or whatever, that it'll probably end up going to trial. So there'll be more testimony, I'm sure, to come about all of this as well, too. What I know that you've had prior to this new development was the reaction from members of the county council to the arrest that happened on Monday, and that's an interesting story in itself. Tell us about that.
Right, and you know, this isn't anything new. The county council, many members of the county council have been calling for Recorder Brown to resign for the last couple of years. If you recall, in 2017, he was accused of sexually harassing a subordinate in his who worked in the Recorder's office. She filed a lawsuit that the county eventually settled, and Lake County taxpayers ended up paying $185,000 to settle that lawsuit. That money had to go through the county council to be approved. So there was some talk of getting rid of him then. And then last year, members of the council figured out that Mike Brown wasn't coming to work anymore.
Yeah.
He argued that because he was suffering mental health issues and various other maladies associated with being at work because it reminded him of his earlier times. So he was trying to limit his liability by not being around people in his office. But that was his argument. The county council's like, you know, you haven't come to work for 2 years. Like that's not right. So they initially pushed to reduce his office salary to $1 a year, which they hoped would sort of encourage him to resign, but he did come in and told them that he was going to be a better person, and they sort of acquiesced in that and allowed him to retain his salary for the year. And he continues to be in office. One of the things his attorney said to me last night was that Mike Brown is going to continue to serve the citizens of Lake County as we work our way through this and the truth becomes known. So it doesn't look like he is intending to resign anytime soon. There is a process to impeach and remove a locally elected official, but it's fairly complicated and rarely used. If he is convicted of a felony, he automatically would lose his office. But, you know, I can't imagine him going to trial before the end of the year when his term expires. So it looks like Lake County residents might just be stuck with this guy till the end of the year.
Oh. One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online, too, it brings us up to date. Now that we have the deadline passed for candidates to file for the primary election ballot, and also now, too, the deadline for withdrawing from the ballot has passed as well, too. Bring us up to date with the candidates who have decided that they didn't want to run for office.
Yeah, the ones that were withdrawing, there was just sort of three candidates who pulled out on Monday, which was the final day. The biggest probably was Calumet Township Board Chairman Darren Washington, who had filed to run for the Indiana Senate in Senate District 3, which is currently represented by Senator Eddie Melton of Gary. If you remember, Senator Melton last year looked at running for governor, organized a campaign to run for the Democratic nomination for governor. He quit that race in January, right at the beginning of the month, right before he would have had to file for governor, and went back to file to run for the Indiana Senate seat again. So Darren Washington said that he wanted to make sure that, the seat wouldn't pass to somebody he didn't think deserved the seat, so he put his name up there. And the off chance Senator Melton wasn't going to run, but now that Senator Melton is back, Darren Washington decided to pull out of the race. Mm-hmm.
And I guess some of the other candidates, I guess there were a couple others as well, too, and you mentioned them more in detail in the story, and I guess they were just people that I guess they were going to run for various offices in Lake County and on the ballot in May, but they just changed their minds apparently too. So we still have a very full field, certainly on the local scene, don't we? Now, I mean, we're not even talking about the scene for U.S. Congress.
Right. Yeah. There's seven Democrats running for Lake County Recorder, one Republican, and then five candidates running for Lake County Coroner, which is a lot of candidates to choose from. And then when you get to the congressional race, there's 20 candidates altogether, both political parties, running for the chance to succeed Congressman Viscosky. So we have a lot of pent-up demand for an opportunity to represent Northwest Indiana in Congress. There's 14 Democrats, 6 Republicans. It's going to be a lot for voters to choose from.
Now let's take a look at the State House, since you've been keeping an eye on that, as well as the Government Center in Crown Point. Bring us up to date on one of the story that you had about the measures that are still, I guess, basically alive, although a number of them, and you talk about that in particular, have died out here in the General Assembly here at halftime, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff sort of moving through the General Assembly. There's stuff that has passed the House that probably isn't going to pass the Senate and vice versa. Probably the biggest thing was, if you recall, the teacher rally in November. You remember a lot of schools had to close because all their teachers were going down to this rally. 15,000 people showed up at the State House to demand higher pay. And in effect, the legislature said, you know, thanks for trying, but you're not getting any extra money until we do a new budget next year. So the one spending bill that was moving this year, because as you know, Indiana does a state budget every other year, so this is a non-budget year. And generally, spending measures don't move at all, but they are moved. They did move one this year to cash fund some university projects instead of borrowing for them, using some extra money that they had at the end of the 2019 budget year. So that was the only spending bill. Democrats tried to amend it to put in some teacher pay items. Those were all voted down by the Republican majorities in the House and Senate, and the bill has gone to the governor, who has signed it into law, and you know, teachers are basically going to have to come back and make their case next year for greater state funding for higher pay.
I understand, too, that one of the other measures that you talk about in your story, too, is the one that, in fact, just got signed into law by the governor the other day, and that's this so-called hold harmless measure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the governor actually signed it into law yesterday. It's the retroactive law, which is a little bit unusual. What it does, Indiana last year transitioned from the I-STEP exam to the I-LEARN exam. These are both Indiana-only tests that, you know, created by the General Assembly for students to take, just standardized exams. But the I-STEP test had a lot of problems with it. Turns out the I-LEARN test is a little bit harder, and a lot of students didn't do very well on it in this first year. Lawmakers and the governor are confident students will do better in future years, but they didn't think it was right to punish schools and teachers by having schools get low accountability grades, you know, these A through F grades that apply to schools, or to some of the teacher pay under state laws passed by the General Assembly is tied to student performance on standardized tests. So they passed this so-called hold harmless to make sure that schools and teachers wouldn't be affected by taking the 2017-18 accountability grade from the last year of the I-STEP exam and using it for last year and for this current school year. So nobody really is going to be affected by the I-LEARN results until the next school year.
I understand, too, that in your story, you mentioned about the fact that there's some other measures that have been shifting around here and on the way to the Senate was the one that State Representative Ed Soliday of Valparaiso has sponsored, which I know has drawn criticism already because it would have made some changes in how quickly that we close out the coal-fired power plants in Indiana, including Northwest Indiana, and go to cleaner energy. Tell us how that turned out and where that's now headed now.
Yeah, House Bill 1414 has passed the House. It's awaiting action in the Senate. It's not clear whether the Senate is going to take it up at all. As you said, it has been very controversial in the House. A lot of lawmakers believe it would has the potential to raise customer utility bills. Nobody wants to get tagged with that in an election year. But, you know, at least a majority, 52 people in the House, voted for it. So there is a majority of people who support it in that chamber, but it's not entirely clear what the effects of the legislation will be. The whole thing has an expiration date, May 1st, 2021, so there's a lot of sort of hype about it saying that it's going to prevent the transition to renewable energy in Indiana, but if that expiration date isn't changed, then everything in this legislation goes away in a year. And basically, that's what Representative Soliday is saying. He wants sort of a planned transition to renewables and not not necessarily allowing or encouraging electric utilities to immediately switch out of coal, because until the replacement renewable resources come online, Indiana is going to need to continue using coal-fired power plants and continue having coal mines. And he's concerned that if the demand for coal goes down, the coal mines will shut down and then you won't have any power at all.
Well, finally, the one story that you have out there in print and online, Dan, is the one story that we've all been watching very carefully. And it's, I guess, and really is the story about the fact that one governor's taken action and another one hasn't. And this is all about the Lake Michigan shoreline erosion problem. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, as I think everybody knows up here, Lake Michigan is incredibly high right now. And then you have these, you know, winter storms, including one today that's sending these 10, 12-foot waves crashing into the shoreline, causing massive erosion because it just hasn't been that cold this winter. You know, tomorrow, you know, there's all this big news about the weather tomorrow because it's really the first time that it's going to dip towards zero. And when it doesn't get very cold, there's no ice shelf that forms along the lakefront. So there's no protection for the dunes and for the, you know, structures and the roads that are adjacent to the shoreline. And this year they're just taking a huge beating from, you know, these winter waves. And leaders in Northwest Indiana, Long Beach and Beverly Shores have appealed to Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb for assistance, requesting that he declare the area a disaster area. and seek federal funding for it. He's refused. He says the damage isn't great enough yet. In Illinois, Governor Pritzker has taken a different tact, and he said, yes, it's clearly a disaster. There's a lot of damage, especially in Chicago. Obviously, the Chicago shoreline is more built up than the Northwest Indiana shoreline, but you know, it's all the same lake, and it's hitting things the same way. So just an interesting dichotomy. The governor of Wisconsin has also declared a disaster area in sort of a Milwaukee-Racine area.
Well, Dan, it sounds like that's another story like the other one earlier with Michael Brown. We're just going to have to stay tuned and find out what gets developed in that one in particular. And thanks for spending time to go over the stories that you've had in print and online so far, and hope to have you back again real soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Thanks, Dan. Dan Carton is the local government reporter and covers local politics and state politics as well, and State House for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And on this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune about the stories that she has out. And in fact, one story that she's been keeping a very close eye on even today. And this follows through with other stories that she's had under the state of the Gary Community School Corporation. And first off, thanks for being with us, Carol.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. And you've just had a chance to finish up keeping an eye on the Distressed Unit Appeals Board as they met in Indianapolis. They've had some interesting stories that come out of there. And, of course, the latest one in particular we've been watching is what the status is going to be on the Roosevelt Career Academy building, the old Roosevelt High School, or as Tommy Williams likes to call it, dear old Roosevelt. And there's been some very big news about that. Tell us what's come about.
Yes, just this morning, we've got a little bit of breaking news for you. The State Distressed Unit Appeal Board voted to close Roosevelt upon the recommendation of Gary's emergency management team. That happened this morning in Indianapolis. The state, of course, controls the Gary School District when it fell into financial distress. Over the past couple decades, actually, that's been happening. But in 2017, the General Assembly approved a measure that handed control to the Distressed Unit Appeal Board. So they acted upon the recommendation of their hired contractor, and they are going to close the school.
What kind of impact do you see that this is going to have on some of the other closed and abandoned schools in the Gary Community School Corporation District? And I know that it's a story that overlaps not only the education scene, but also overlaps the city government scene, too, because it's got a story. In fact, your colleague Carrie Napoleon had a story about that recently, too, about what the Gary mayor would like to do. And there's a discussion, I guess, about whether some action is going to be taken anytime soon about those old buildings.
It's a little early to guess what the impact would be. It may not, however, fall into the same state of deterioration as some of the other schools we witness across the city, because there's so much alumni and community love for Roosevelt. The next step following this closure, the other part of the motion was to seek proposals from the community or other entities to take over the ownership of Roosevelt. Possibly an alumni group could come through if they get financial backing to turn the school into the museum or other community use as it sees fit if it gains the funding. So there is such a strong emotional tie to Roosevelt, which is one of just three schools, high schools built in Indiana in the 1920s during the segregationist period, and they were built exclusively to house black students because white students did not want them in their classrooms.
Mm-hmm. I think Christmas Attucks in Indianapolis is one of the other ones, too. Yeah,
Christmas Attucks and a school in Evansville is the other one.
Mm-hmm. I know this, and then you keep track of some of the things that have happened involving the buildings that the Gary Community School Corporation has been dealing with. And like I said, this was kind of a crossover in as far as these closed and abandoned buildings. And we've had you talk about this and some of the stories you've had in the past about dealing with that and trying to find bidders for some of the buildings and the like. And that's, I think, the next step that I guess the emergency manager and his team is going through now, isn't it?
Yeah, they launched another sale period last month, and it ends in March. They are saying that they're seeing significant movement, and they won't give us a firm number, but they say that they have offers on several of the schools. Roosevelt was not among the schools put out for sale.
Yeah, I think there's one of the other high schools that this certainly has been closed and is in disuse and has been abandoned is a school like Lew Wallace High School there on the Glen Park neighborhood. So that there are places like that that are certainly worse shape. So I'm supposing that even though there are problems with the heating system at Roosevelt, it's not as bad as what it could have been in some other buildings, to be sure. So. Do you think that I know, and in fact that even the emergency management teams had recent meetings even this week talking about these issues. Do you know if they brought up the issue that came up today before the DUAB about the Roosevelt building?
They held a public hearing on Roosevelt last week. It drew about 100 people, and most of them, of course, did not want the school to close. There was plenty of blame and criticism, but not a lot of solutions or suggestions to keep the school open.
So what is going to be the procedure now, getting back to the Gary Roosevelt building situation, now that we've gotten official action from the Distressed Unit Appeals Board, is it going to get turned back over to the MGT management team, the people that are actually kind of running things in the Gary schools?
It's a little unclear what will happen, but MGT officials have said that they're going to put a national request for proposals out there, and they will be taking letters of interest from groups that want to take over Roosevelt. What that entails, we don't know yet, whether these groups will actually purchase the school or whether the school district will donate it. That's all a little foggy at this point.
Do you think that it's a case where, you know, because we have more public input now, obviously, we know what the citizens and Gary have to say about Roosevelt. They made them very well known. They can say that the recent meeting that they had not long ago, before today's developments with the state in with the state board in Indianapolis. Do you just think it's going to be a case where we're going to have to, I guess, prod them along a little bit more? That is, the community will have to prod them along a little bit more to get some action here, even though they've got, you say they've got this plan for a national proposals out.
I don't know. I think that they will follow through on what they're saying. They've announced it publicly a couple times. I can't imagine that they would fall back on that pledge. The MGT officials do seem to be aware of the legacy of this school, and they say that they will honor it. So hopefully they will.
Well, they certainly heard about that. They learned the legacy if they didn't know before, that they certainly found out at the meeting that they had in Gary not long ago. So, well, Carol, thank you very much for spending time with us, and thank you for giving us the update on today's meeting with the Distressed Unit Appeals Board about the plans to close the Roosevelt building, and we'll just have to see what gets turned back over to folks here in Gary and how it's going to be handled from that point on. And we thank you for joining us to talk about it today on the program.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we talk with Joe Pete, who handles the business news for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and a number of stories he's had put out there in print and online to check into, in particular, some stories involving a neighborhood that has had a share of environmental issues is back in the news. And this time we're not talking necessarily about the neighborhood around the housing project, but another neighborhood that has a lot of hazardous waste issues to talk about. First, Joe, thanks for being with us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the one story that I know that you had a chance to look into further, and maybe people who are listeners may not even have been aware of this. This has been, I guess, brought up the things that led to the discovery and, in turn, the investigation of hazardous waste at the former City Services refinery in East Chicago. It's been so long ago for many people, although not everybody, that they will not remember what happened there. Bring us up to date first about the refinery itself, its own history and legacy now, and the toxic legacy that it seems to leave behind.
Yes. Well, the refinery is partly still in use. The Sitco Petroleum Corp. does use most of the site still for petroleum storage. It was a refinery in East Chicago's Indiana Harbor neighborhood that dates back to like the early 20th century. It kind of it ended up being shut down in the 70s after a long period of commercial decline and changing ownership several times. There had been an explosion. I assume that's what you're referring to. There was an explosion there. In I believe 1980, because of there was a lot of naphtha in an abandoned tank that got ignited, and at this point, CITGO is operating about 228 acres of it on the northern part, handling about 180 million gallons of petroleum products at any given time. The part that's been kind of shut down is the southern end, which is 93 acres. That's owned by Oxy. It's been pretty much vacant for decades. All the above ground structures, refining structures, have been, you know, dismantled and torn down. Most of that took place in the 80s. There are still underground tanks, and there is concerns by the EPA, which has been looking obviously more into the pollution in the Chicago area. They've been looking into whether there's groundwater and soil contamination. They have mandated that Oxy and CITGO Petroleum investigate the site to determine whether there is any hazardous waste, and if so, to clean it up.
When you did your research to come out with the story, did you find out whether the folks in the Region 5 EPA office in Chicago had just kind of gone back through the files and realized, well, there's another problem that we probably should bring up that hasn't been brought up for a while or at all? Or did they get complaints about the former city service refinery site that kind of led to this investigation into the hazardous waste area?
They've been taking a more comprehensive look at East Chicago and kind of the legacy of industrial pollution there in light of the event. With the earlier events, it's kind of sparked more of a review, and this is the result of that.
Is there any indication that first off, it's I'm sure going to take a while to get everything together in the investigation, but they are going to turn over the results to the city hall and let the residents within the city of East Chicago know more about it?
Yes, there's no timeline right now for when it's or at least it has been made public. But the test results will be made accessible. They'll be required to post them online and to post them at the local libraries.
One of the other stories that you have out there that to see in print as well as online is a story that deals with workforce issues. The Indiana Workforce Recovery is partnering with a company to set up a new initiative that will help workers deal with addiction. Tell us more about that.
Yes. The Indiana Workforce Recovery was kind of formed a couple of years ago by the Indiana Chamber and the Indiana Chamber, the governor's office. They're looking to really do something about the opioid epidemic that's been, you know, plaguing the state for some time. They've been trying to kind of help people recover and maintain meaningful employment. They've been looking at different ways to, because also the unemployment in the state, it's not just an issue. There's obviously the issue of people who are suffering with addiction, but then there's the issue of employers. Unemployment is at 3.2% in Indiana, has been in months. It's a very tight labor market. People are hard to come by. So employers are interested in, more so than ever before, maintaining the staffs that they have and, they're in look for good qualified people. And sometimes when they have employees with addiction issues, the goal of this initiative is for them to get help to be able to, keep people on their team. They are partnering with the Mental Health and Addiction Service Provider Centerstone now. They have worked with clients in a couple different cities, but they're trying to roll it out as a statewide program where employers can set up like addiction recovery programs. The Centerstone will basically come in and help them set up, will help them, establish protocols and procedures for their own programs, making sure it's kind of in line with state law. The state kind of absolves the companies now too of liability if they choose to try to help employees. They can't then be, sued for, but anyway.
One of the other stories that you had out there recently too, that is a local story here too, and I'm didn't, I guess, prep you ahead of time, so to speak, about this. But it is one that came out earlier. Is a report that came out from the Commercial Insights Class A Office Market Report. And we like to find out lately, because we see so many buildings that are for rent or for lease here in Northwest Indiana, and office buildings in particular. What's the latest report have to say about how many of our Northwest Indiana office buildings are really, really full, as they should be to begin with?
Yes, the vacancy rate in Northwest Indiana office market for Class A office space, and this is pretty much just like the new, like brand new top of the market office space. This doesn't reflect a lot of older properties that have suffered some decline, but it fell from to 17% in Northwest Indiana last year, down from 19% a year higher. It still is relatively higher than the rest of suburban Chicagoland, where it's at only about 12%. But more than a third of the multi-tenant office buildings are 100% occupied. One's at like 99%. Most of the vacancies are in Merrillville, where you have the biggest cluster of offices by, you know, the 65 and US 30. A lot of them are entirely in the 8585 Broadway office tower, the 8-story tower. It's the tallest Class A office building in Northwest Indiana. It is. People might remember it as the Gainer Bank building, or more recently the Chase building, but Chase is basically pulled out of there, and they have new tenants like a wealth advising firm and other tenants. But it's they recently did a big multi-million dollar renovation, and they've been trying to bring new companies in, but it's been a struggle. And then the highest amount of vacancy is probably in Lake County. You're seeing it around 23%, although most of the new office buildings are buildings such as the ones in Hammond by the Borman Expressway. They fill up almost right away. It's lower in Porter County, where it's 2 to 3%, but the inventory in Porter County has been kind of stagnant and hasn't moved for. There's been a lot of investment in new office buildings in Lake County, where they haven't really been building any new multi-tenant office buildings for just the general market in Porter County in some time.
Well, Joe, I want to take an opportunity here. You had a great story that came out at length there, a very personal story, as a matter of fact, about your brother Tom, who's not only done very well, certainly in his chosen career, done, in fact, so well that he's picked up some nominations for films that he's worked in. I'll let you take the time left to talk about your brother Tom, what you were able to, I guess, in a way, being in the family, talk about the issue of being an actor and being involved in films and television, too.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's worked for a while, for a few years now, as a background actor, extra in movies and television. He's appeared in a wide array of movies and film, including John Wick 2. He's been in John Wick 2. He's been in... most recently, he's been in three Oscar-nominated films. He was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in the scene where Bruce Lee's character is fighting with Brad Pitt's character. He appears in Ford versus Ferrari, and also in Ford versus Ferrari, and then in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Ford versus Ferrari. And he was in the Golden Globe-nominated Dolomite Is My Name, and I'm sorry, the third one is escaping me. But he was in several Oscar nominated films for some years, or for this year. He's just, it's kind of been a dream of his. He's been a lifelong fan of film and movies and television, and he just enjoys, you know, working on these sets around directors like Tarantino. Oh, and The Irishman. He was also in The Irishman. He plays a reporter who's interviewing Jimmy Hoffa's Al Pacino. I like to joke that he, you know, draws a lot of his inspiration from me.
Do you get the impression that he really, really enjoys being kind of in the background? He's an extra, I guess. You mentioned in some of the films, in particular, but he likes that role in the movies rather than being a star, so to speak.
Oh well, no. Well, he's never sought that. It's just he kind of he fell into this. He went out into New York and he just found that there was a lot of the television and film productions were looking for, you know, extras, and he realized, you know, you can pretty much go and do this every day at a different film set. And he deliberately chose to work like kind of in the background actor role, where he's not necessarily going to get any lines, and he'll only be on screen for a few seconds, but that way he can get steady work and he doesn't have to compete for, you know, roles. And it's not, this way he's able to work on a film set basically every day instead of, you know, you hear the cliches in Hollywood where it's a lot of like waiters and, you know, so forth. And then they're waiting for the call, and he's not so much interested in that as he's just like working steadily in the industry. So this is kind of the path he's forged for himself, which is, you know, pretty interesting and cool because he gets to, you know, work with, he grew up like loving Pulp Fiction, and he gets to, you know, be on set with Quentin Tarantino, and, yeah, he's definitely enjoying himself.
Do you get the impression that he really, I guess, likes it because it's more steady work, I suppose, than being a star? Although it just depends on the star, too, whether you get to be called in to do a film or do a cameo or something in another film. Does he enjoy this opportunity? It's more steady work, as you say.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, no, it's just the excitement of working on these different projects and, you know, seeing actors, and, you know, he's grown up loving, you know, getting to work with them on the same projects, but he's appeared in a number of, you know, film sets, everything from, he was, worked on Captain Marvel. He did end up being in that one in the Marvel Cinematic Universe because he was supposed to be like a government employee walking down a tunnel, while Samuel L. Jackson and Captain Marvel were driving into the secret Air Force base. But then the director at the last minute decided that, why would the government employees be walking through this tunnel? So they cut out, you know, him and everyone else who was supposed to be in that scene. And he just got to sit around on set and eat craft services and watch, that Australian actor, Chainsmoke, was kind of how it played out. But he, it's a living, and it's just something he finds exciting. He's never really trained, never really received any training as an actor. Formally, I don't remember what he studied in college, but it wasn't, he didn't study theater or anything, but it's just, you know, something cool that he enjoys doing. And,
do you think that Tom, because he's done so well, he's had a steady work, because of what he's been doing lately here, that he's just, I guess, because he's just a regular person, he's not a character actor per se, so he's not on call, I guess, or waiting for some specific role that might fit him, but he can fit into a number of things, apparently.
Oh, sure. He's played all kinds of, it's all brief roles, but he's, he often plays a reporter. Or, you know, sometimes it's just a bystander, but it'll be, he's played a reporter, he played a husband on one, like, true crime TV show. He's been, it's a lot of just everyman roles. He plays a paramedic in the upcoming Jonathan Nolan film, Tenant, which sounded interesting because he had to do scenes where he's running forward, and then he had to run in reverse because there's some kind of time hopping going on in that. But he plays typically just a lot of, everyman roles. And once upon a time in Hollywood, it was almost meta because he ended up playing like a film crew member. He was a film crew member, on the set of this movie that it was the Western they were filming for the movie. And he adapts to it. Sometimes they move him around. He'll often be in some kind of like setting where he's a reporter and they'll have an interview and he'll be a reporter and they'll switch him to the cameraman, or they'll switch him from the cameraman or the photographer to the reporter or that type of thing. But he's, he wholeheartedly enjoys, sometimes he's able to, ham it up a little in a few seconds of screen time. There was one on the show, The Goldbergs, where they gave this like zany speech and they cut to him for the reaction shot. And he just gives this like aghast expression, and he's able to get a little bit of humor into the, in The Irishman, for instance, the Al Pacino's Jimmy Hoffa character was talking about how this other union member spent all his time playing golf or whatever. And my brother is on screen for several seconds and he shakes his head. He just shakes his head like in kind of, exaggerated disgust, which an actual reporter probably wouldn't do, during a press conference, but it's, an amusing reaction, and it's good to see him. When he gets more, because sometimes, we're very, obviously our family are very proud of him and we'll watch everything he's in, but it's often, he'll be in a big movie where he's just one of 1,000 background actors in a crowd and he doesn't necessarily get any screen time. There was like The Girl on the Train, I think, like he was in, Union Station, or John Wick 2, he was in the train when Keanu Reeves and Common were having like a gunfight. And you don't necessarily end up like seeing him, on screen. So it's always a treat when he does end up, you know, where he's visible and his face is on there, or if he gets the chance to, like, react to something they're doing.
Well, Joe, thank you for spending so much more time talking about your brother Tom and his very, very interesting job. And you mentioned some of the things in the story. You'll have to look at the Times Online or the print version to read more about this, about how Tom Pete has managed to turn what seemed like an opportunity into a real profession, maybe a kind of a sideways way, a version of a real profession, as some may think. But it's interesting just the same. And thank you for spending time with us talking about your brother and about these other business stories that we have here in Northwest Indiana from the Times. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Valparaiso University is going to host the annual Polar Plunge event coming up this weekend, which is, of course, benefiting Special Olympics Indiana. And to tell us more about it, we have one of the organizers of the event. Assistant Valparaiso University Police Chief Chuck Garber is with us. And, Chief, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris, for allowing me to talk a little bit.
Now, tell us more about the Special Olympics Indiana event and how important this is to get the word out and to educate people in Northwest Indiana about folks that maybe are a little bit different from the run-of-the-mill folks in Indiana.
So what Special Olympics is, it's a nonprofit organization that basically it's part of the global Special Olympics movement, and that's Special Olympics Indiana. And that's who we're actually doing the fundraiser for. They utilize sport, health, education, and leadership programs to help empower folks with intellectual disabilities and help educate others on the discrimination actions against them. About 10 years ago, the police department started doing the Polar Plunge. We took the lead role in it, bringing it to the campus. And our thoughts was to get community members in Northwest Indiana, and our campus, our students, staff, and faculty all involved, mm-hmm. that we could raise more money. And it's really been successful for 10 years.
One of the things that maybe people are not aware of is the fact that because this happens on the Valparaiso University campus, you have some of the perfect places to hold this. So you wouldn't think that they would be perfect. I suppose polar plunges are typically considered by like a big lake or a pond or something, or even in this case around here, Lake Michigan. But you all have the perfect spot to be able to have this kind of event.
Yes, we hold it right outside the Athletic Recreation Center on campus, kind of in the center of campus. We bring a 14-foot pool about 4 feet deep. We set up scaffolding to go in there, and all the participants get to jump in the pool and get back out and then go to the after splash.
Tell us more about the after splash. That's it's going to happen actually inside the arc, isn't it?
Correct. What we do is we all the participants, all the volunteers get to eat free. We'll have wings, pizza, sandwiches, pastry goods, some pop, water. And folks that just want to watch the Polar Plunge, they can come for $5 and do a donation, and they can eat all they want to eat as well. We'll have the Crusader Pep Band and a DJ playing. We'll have music outside, inside. Mm-hmm. During the plunge, we'll have a contest, a costume contest, and it's pretty elaborate, all the costumes that show up for this. You can plunge as an individual. You can plunge as a team. Then we have awards for most money raised individually, most money team, and the one that I always get a kick out of is the costume contest.
If you will, tell us about in past polar plunges that you've been part of, what kinds of costumes do you recall seeing the participants as they jump into the pool to wear?
Well, superheroes. I've seen firefighters go in full fire gear.
Mm-hmm.
Our police department has went in our police uniforms 1 year, and I really enjoyed this. We gave our police uniforms to fraternity brothers, and they joined our team, and we wore prisoners' outfits from the county jail. And that one got a lot of publicity.
I imagine it would. And that was probably quite a sight to see, to be sure, out there. Even if it isn't for a real long time, it's still a chance to see all the setup, I guess, as the participants get all set up and ready to jump into the water, to be sure. It's a big event, of course, as you mentioned. It's going to benefit the Special Olympics of Indiana. Tell us, if you will, how you feel and your personal experiences, perhaps, about having opportunities like this to give folks that have, I guess, special disabilities a chance to be part of the team, so to speak, not only that, but part of the community as well.
From a personal note, I truthfully, and this from the heart, I feel I'm blessed. Every year I get to spend just a little bit of time with the athletes, and it's amazing to see what Special Olympics, the leadership they teach, this team building. And the one thing that I, and this is going to sound different, but I look at these athletes, and they don't show all the biases that we see all over the world. They're all about inclusion. They don't care if you're small, if you're big, if you're black, you're white, anything. They, to me, are truly, and that's one of the things Special Olympics really teaches, inclusion. Something that Special Olympics is doing now, it's called Unified Sports.
Mm-hmm.
So high schools across the country are joining the athletes, the Special Olympians, and they're competing together. And that's just that's starting a whole new generation to work with these folks that are struggling. To me, that's just a positive way to go.
You talk about what organizations that are involved during the plunge itself. We have, of course, not only individuals that have special disabilities and the opportunities they have to be part of the community, and about the organizations outside of the Valparaiso University community as well. Do you find a lot of high school students and high school teams that like to get involved in this polar plunge every year?
They do, but then they're also, Special Olympics is done this unified sports where they're doing it throughout the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they're playing baseball together, maybe they're bowling, maybe they're playing basketball. So they're taking our high school students and athletes and actually playing the games with the Special Olympians, which to me, that's just totally unifying everybody.
Now, do you find that in that case particular, we'll say a baseball team, perhaps some Special Olympics members have been involved in a baseball team for a high school, like Valparaiso High School, maybe in turn that's kind of given them the incentive to want to do the polar plunge? They're just continuing on the team spirit, aren't they?
Absolutely. It just, to me, this snowballs. When you get folks working together, breaking some bread together, it's catchy. It's just putting a better tomorrow.
Now, can you give us a place where people can find out more information about the, not only about Special Olympics Indiana, but also about the Polar Plunge, which is coming up here this weekend on Saturday there at Valparaiso University?
If you want to directly go to our Polar Plunge site, if you go 2020 Valparaiso University Polar Plunge and you hit the register part, it will take you into the Valpo plunge.
Mm-hmm.
It'll show you exactly how much money we have made, you know, for this plunge up to the minute. It will show you the teams. Matter of fact, that's a good place if you don't want to get in the water. You can donate there. If you have family members or friends or a team that you know, you could actually donate right online to their part of their fundraiser. And then you can always go to the Indiana Special Olympics Polar Plunge site as well.
Well, Chief, thank you very much for spending time with us, telling us a little about not only the event coming up, the annual Polar Plunge, which is going to happen on Saturday the 15th at the Athletics Recreation Center, the ARC, as it's better known, on the Valparaiso University campus, but a little bit about your thoughts about Special Olympics in general and the people that are most not only benefiting from the Special Olympics, but also that are involved in it as well. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much to Dan Carden and Joe Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana, to Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune, and to Valparaiso University Assistant Police Chief Chuck Garber telling us about the Polar Plunge, which is coming up on Saturday, starting out outdoors at the ARC and then moving indoors. And we'll be back with you on Monday with more of Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.